Come out to Shindig this Tuesday, November 29th to see Carousel, Talkers, and Viewmaster.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Welcome back. Today is Friday, November 25th, and I'm Anya Zolojowski.
And I'm Francesca Bianco. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's currently 5:12, and it's time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
To start the show, we have News 101 reporter Yusheng Tsai's report on Kindler Society, a Vancouver-based student-led nonprofit collecting books for children in developing countries.
Following that, we have a live discussion with News 101 reporter Andrew Seal on how the iMed health insurance policy makes it difficult for UBC's international students to afford birth control.
Following that, we have Jake Clark in the studio live to discuss how to break your own media bubbles. And then we have an arts and culture report by Anya Christina on More or Less's new album.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, Santa Ano was officially installed as UBC's 15th president. On Wednesday morning, distinguished guests and members of the UBC community gathered at the Chan Center for the official installation of Dr. Santa J. Ano as the 15th president and vice chancellor of UBC. Ano received official greetings from the Musqueam First Nation, the Okanagan Nation Alliance, the Government of Alberta, the Government of British Columbia, and the City of Vancouver via representatives who spoke at the ceremony. The ceremony included an oath of office performed by the Honorable Judith Guichon, Lieutenant Governor of British Columbia, and an official robing performed by Stuart Belkin, the Chair of the Board of Governors. In his installation address, Ano spoke of his strategic plan to bring the university from excellence to eminence. No one person holds the key to an organization. No powerful dean, no board chair, no renowned professor, no enthusiastic AMS president, and certainly no president and vice chancellor holds the keys on his or her own, said Ano. The truth is that we all hold the keys in trust to preserve, strengthen, and ultimately to leave this beautiful institution to the next generation in a better place than it once was left to us. The installation ceremony was the first of various events to celebrate UBC's 15th president, including an afternoon forum with speakers from the academic community and a celebration concert at the Chan Center later this evening. UBC Get Confessions Get Serious. UBC Confessions is intended to be an anonymous and lighthearted outlet for students to share personal stories which took place on campus. While the majority of the content is relatively innocent, some confessions that were posted in October worried many students. Two particular posts were taken down after they made students feel uncomfortable. one by a student who was told to take Plan B by another student, and the other by an intimidated student afraid to go to class because of their professor's actions towards them. The UBC reached out to UBC Confessions, which is run by upper year undergraduates, for their publishing policy and what their stance is on reaching out to students who appear to be in distress. They said, UBC Confessions administrators, in a written statement, and one of the admins had recommended that we filter out confessions that were not up to par by using a rating system, which is what we currently use. The administrators tried to avoid posting content such as confessions with that feature the names of people not in the public eye, assault, reposted topics, questions about opinions on classes, and confessions that may be overly offensive to a huge number of people. They also added that the ones that do commonly get posted and get the best feedback are the hilarious and creative ones that are also related to UBC and or student life, they wrote. We also favor confessions that we think would incite meaningful discussion among the UBC community. In explanation of the two posts in question and why they passed the content guidelines of the page, they stated that they thought it was important to get the word out about the cruelty that some students face. In their written statement, they said, "We had posted them because we felt that perhaps the UBC community should be aware that this was happening on campus."
In local news, Vancouver mulls on property tax hike and prepares for future housing projects. Vancouver is preparing to ask residents to pay higher property taxes as the city spends tens of millions of dollars on projects aimed at tackling its housing crisis. A 2017 draft envisions a 3.7% increase to property taxes, with the city preparing to create new rental units and social housing, along with other projects such as parks and new cycling and walking paths. Councillor Jeff Meggs, the chair of the Finance Committee and a member of the Majority Vision Vancouver Party, on council said, quote, "There's huge pressure from the community to continue with our investments in housing." The draft budget envisions putting $80 million into affordable housing projects, the largest amount to date that Vancouver has spent in a year. That will include $30 million for what is labeled rental affordable housing units, $9 million for a housing site in the East Fraserlands being developed in the city's southeast corner, and another $5 million for land downtown for social housing. The city's higher-than-inflation tax increase appears to be about equal to what Surrey is considering, as it also deals with pressures to combat crime and provide increased services as population continues to mushroom. Woman who accused Stephen Galloway of sexual assault breaks her silence. The woman who accused Stephen Galloway of sexual assault and harassment says her complaint to the university just over a year ago was not about a consensual relationship with Mr. Galloway, who was fired as chair of the creative writing program at the University of British Columbia, where she was a student. The main complainant, MC, released a statement on Thursday through Joanna Birnbaum, her lawyer, the first time she has spoken publicly since Mr. Galloway was suspended as a result of her allegations. Quote, "The allegations that were investigated in this case include that Mr. Galloway sexually harassed and sexually assaulted MC," said the statement. Mr. Galloway was suspended with pay last November and fired in June without severance due to breach of trust. This followed a months-long independent investigation by former BC Supreme Court Judge Mary Ellen Boyd and subsequent reviews by the Dean of Arts and then President. According to Mr. Galloway's statement, Ms. Boyd found on a balance of probabilities that he had not committed sexual assault. His statement said the report concluded that he had an affair with a student for about 2 years. He expressed profound regret and apologized. The main complainant issued her statement in response to Mr. Galloway's. She said, quote, "He wouldn't appear to be apologizing for the finding he has admitted was made against him by Ms. Boyd, which was misconduct for inappropriate sexual behavior with a student, conduct which is an abuse of trust and his position of power. Mr. Galloway has not made clear to whom he is apologizing or what he regrets, other than presumably the consequences to him. His reference to the tragedy of events does not explicitly consider the devastating impacts of abuse or power on women affected."
In national news, the federal government has pledged to virtually eliminate coal use by 2030. The Liberals have set out a plan to eliminate coal-fired electricity by 2030, but will give some authority to provincial governments. Environment Minister Catherine McKenna announced the plan yesterday ahead of the first minister's meeting in December, when Justin Trudeau hopes to finalize a pan-Canadian climate accord. McKenna said that Ottawa will be working with the provinces to increase investment in more affordable, cleaner options. Only four provinces are still operating plants that burn coal for electricity. This is, however, a provision in the plan that will allow provincial governments to leave some of the plants open if they achieve emission reductions elsewhere. Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall has denounced the federal planning, saying he won't sign the climate accord next month unless Ottawa withdraws its plans for a national price on carbon. Phasing out coal should prevent up to 1,000 premature deaths and save the healthcare system billions. The government's plan comes just as President-elect Trump has pledged to resurrect America's coal industry. Plastic microbeads are to be banned in Canada by mid-2018. The sale of toothpastes, shower gels, and facial products containing microbeads will no longer be legal after July 1, 2018. Microbeads found in natural health products and non-prescription drugs will be banned a year later. The United States has also banned the tiny pollutants that often end up in water systems since they don't dissolve. After a study by Environment Canada, the beads were declared toxic in June of this year. The manufacture and import of the toxic beads will be banned by the beginning of the year, 6 months before the sales ban. The industry has already started to phase out microbeads, as many other countries are expected to enact bans.
In international news, Israel evacuates nearly 60,000 people after forest fire spreads in northern city. The city of Haifa, Israel's third largest city, was hit by a wildfire on Thursday, forcing tens of thousands of people to evacuate their homes. Authorities suspect that the blaze may have been set by politically motivated arsonists. There have been no reports of fatalities, but several dozen people have been hospitalized for smoke inhalation. The fire spread quickly due to dry and windy weather. The blaze is the largest of several fires that have erupted across the country in recent days. Several countries, including Russia, Cyprus, Turkey, Croatia, and Greece, sent firefighting planes to assist Israel in tackling the fires. The fire triggered memories for Haifa residents of the deadly brush fire in 2010, which killed 45 people and burned out only after 4 days. A 7,300-year-old city has been excavated in Egypt. A cemetery and residential city dating back over 7,300 years were discovered by archaeologists in a dig close to existing historical sites along the River Nile. Mohamed Afifi, head of the Egyptian Antiquities Sector, said that the find dated back to BCE 5316, which was the beginning of Egypt's first dynasty. The discovery was made 400 meters south of the King Seti Temple in Abydos City. Abydos is considered to have been Egypt's capital during its pre-dynastic and early dynastic times, and the latest excavation could help prove that claim. A report in the local Egypt Independent newspaper said, quote, remains of huts and daily life tools were found in the site, including the remains of pottery and stone tools, which indicates that the residential city supplied the labor force engaged in the construction of royal tombs with food and drink. Egyptian officials hope that this new excavation, which would help boost tourism, which has been taken a hit after civil unrest, political upheavals, and two airplane incidents in recent years. More than 14 million tourists have visited the country in 2010, but less than 3 million have arrived in the first 7 months of 2016. Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Bursaries, scholarships, buildings, research projects, sporting events, you name it, it's likely been supported by donors. Giving is a powerful thing, and coming up is the day to celebrate it. Giving Tuesday is on November 29. Give thanks and share your own giving stories using hashtag UBCGiving. Find out more at ubc.ca/giving.
Sure, you've heard of Black Friday and Cyber Monday, but what about Giving Tuesday? November 29th is an international day of giving to celebrate the importance of philanthropy. Join in by sharing your giving stories on social media using hashtag UBCGiving. Find out more at ubc.ca/givingtuesday.
News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have News 101's reporter Yusheng Tsai's report on Kindler Society, a Vancouver-based student-led nonprofit collecting books for children in developing countries.
Called Kindler Society has quietly become the largest youth-led nonprofit in Western Canada, and their plan is to grow and expand through events and outreach. Kindler Society was founded and is run by high school students. It was set up to collect books locally and distribute them to schools in developing countries. Tina Tan is the president of Kindler Society. Tan's organization started almost 5 years ago and is made up of high school students from across the Lower Mainland. I spoke to Tina Tan to talk about how the Kindler Society, as a Vancouver-based organization, get access to the developing countries and children living there.
I'm wondering the process of reaching out to certain countries, how you pick up these countries.
Oh yeah, so that's an elaborate process. For the Philippines, it's because last year we shipped 12,500 books to the Philippines, and how we reached out to them was because one of the members in Kindler Society has personal contact with one of the elementary schools in the more impoverished areas in Philippines, and basically we connected with them. She personally went to the Philippines to volunteer there and to read books to them.
Is she from Philippines?
Yeah. No, she isn't from the Philippines, but she had connection, and then she reached out to them, and then she volunteered there, out of her own pocket, and she felt that it was such a huge impact being there to herself to volunteer. So we basically sent the books to the Philippines, but when we sent it there, one of the first steps is to communicate with the school, which we just covered. The second step is to get approval from the government. So we need to negotiate with the government and to make sure that we're certified to do such a task, to send that many books to a country. And then we have to talk to the shipment company. We have to sign a bunch of contracts, talk about the liability of it. And after we send it there, we have to talk to a storage area, because sometimes the schools don't have the resources to pick up the books immediately. So then we need to talk to the storage areas around the Philippines port area to store the books for a short time period.
So what do you really talk to the government? How to persuade them? Is there any like barriers for you?
But yes, there is a huge barrier.
Kind
of. Such as them responding in time. Sometimes it takes a while for them to respond to us.
How long
to
does
us.
It take?
I think our longest record was 1.5 months to 2 months. Yes. So it takes a while for us to communicate. We also sent it, a few years ago, we sent it to the Nepals, and that took a while.
I also talked to Matthew Remedios, one of the regional managers of the Kindlers, to know about what has been changed over the past 5 years.
So, in these 4 years, is there any change of the society, Kindler Society?
I think right now we're focusing a lot more on like the spreading awareness part. So I know before we focused a lot on shipments, and we're still obviously doing that. So we were founded in December 31st, 2012, and then we've been doing shipments all across the world. So places in Shanghai, China. We shipped to two locations in northern Iraq. Yeah, I think a really big focus for this year, and especially like Kindler's moving on from that, is sort of bringing the awareness part to it.
You mean from focusing mainly on the shipment?
Right. So what we want to do is we're sort of trying to spread awareness about why we're doing the certain things that we do. Mm-hmm. So why we give the books to the places we need to, that we sponsor and such, because a lot of the time people just think, oh, we just ship books over there, but they don't really know the reason. So we're trying to give a lot of background information through maybe like the media and other sources, through speakers at events and such like that.
Remedios is now a grade 12 student, and he talked about the reason why he decided to join the Kindlers.
So right now I'm a grade 12 student, mm-hmm. and essentially I heard about Kindlers from a really close friend of mine, and she was talking about how it was a really great experience to get involved in. It was a really great thing to do. So they were doing a bunch of fundraisers, and I went to one of their fundraisers actually just to sort of help out and just sort of see what people thought. So I remember it was one time we were just fundraising on the corner of Robson and Granville, I believe. So we were fundraising there, and a lot of people were stopping by and just wondering, oh, what is Kindler Society? And once they heard about our cause and heard about like what we're trying to fundraise for, they're like, oh yeah, that's a great cause. That's a really good thing to get involved in, and that's a cause I'm willing to support. And personally, when I first sort of signed up for Kindlers, tried to apply, I really kept that in mind. And personally, it aligns with like sort of my personal values, like trying to give people the same opportunities or trying to give people opportunity that they may not have or may not be sort of accessible to them. So here I'm very, you know, lucky to have everything that I have. So it's just trying to, you know, bridge the gap between sort of maybe a little bit of what I have to trying to help somebody else out.
Lev Carrison is the co-founder of Givers Group, and I reached out to him on the phone to also talk about Kindlers Society and his own connection with the Kindlers.
Hey, so the way that I found the Kindlers Society was I was hosting my own birthday party, and usually on my birthday parties what I do is I collect a charity organization. Mm-hmm. And what I do is I fundraise for that charity with my friends and peers. So what I did for my last birthday, which was in September, this past September, I chose the Kindlers Society. And the way that I did that was because I got interested in good books. I was really interested in books. And I felt like that was the right society to fundraise for. So I didn't really know much about the Kindlers Society. I was actually introduced to them through the event where I was having the event. I met somebody there, and they told me about the Kindlers Society. And I know that the Kindlers Society kind of wanted to host an event at the same venue that I was having it at. So that's kind of how I found out about them. But what we ended up doing is we ended up raising, she said over 500 books for that they were going to get shipped out to, I forget where now. I think, I want to say Mexico and
yeah.
Some other people. I don't really know, like, I know Tina because she came over and she did a speech and that was amazing. And I know that, you know, the reason why we collect books for the Kindler Society is contribute to people who can't afford books, which I thought was very unique because not a lot of organizations do that. And the logistics behind that is very, like when I was talking to Tina about it, the logistics is really, really complicated because now you're talking about a mass volume of hard copy books that you're shipping out in containers, which cost money. And then some countries don't even allow these containers to come through. So she's told me about some difficulties that she's had with this, with shipping books outside of the country as well, which is really cool. But coming through those obstacles, I mean, I feel like they do a good job, but it's also very demanding and hard.
Sorry, I want to know, you said that Kindlers Society, you think it's a very unique organization. What kind of unique do you think, like?
Well, it's unique in a way that a lot of things are digital these days, and I feel that they go, like, more, I don't want to say historic, but I don't want to say primitive either. Like, they just go with, like, a older type of approach. Because, like, you know, a new approach would be to send out, I don't know, iPads or some technology for people. And then they can kind of reuse that or use it for more purposes. But when you're sending out books, really there's only so many, like, there's only one use out of a book, right? You read the book and you're done with it. So I find it's unique because not a lot of organizations are doing it. They're the only one that I found that was doing it. I know there's some in the States that do it. Particularly, there's a celebrity that does this kind of like a book charity thing where she collects old youth books and she sends them out to people who request them for free. But yeah, that's kind of where the uniqueness I thought of that.
Mm-hmm. I want to sort of clarify, do you think that Kindlers Society is the only organization doing so, collecting books collecting paper books for developing countries in the lower mainland. Is there any other similar organization doing the similar things?
No, I found.
Okay. And also, I want to know sort of your motivation to help Kindle Society, except for that you are very interested in books. Is there any other motivation that you...
Well, I feel like our future generation is very important, and I've always kind of thought of that, that like children are should be the primary focus of us in educating them moving forward, and especially in developing countries where they don't have the privileges that we have out here. So I feel that the motivation doesn't really lie just in collecting books and helping the Kindler Society and me loving books myself. I think the real motivation lies in helping our future generation.
Thank you, Yusheng. We now have a live discussion. Thank you, Yusheng. We now have a live discussion with News 101 reporter Andrew Seal on how the iMed health insurance policy makes it difficult for UBC's international students to afford birth control.
First, we're going to take a quick PSA break. Stay tuned for more contributor segments.
To Black Friday and Cyber Monday, but what about Giving Tuesday? November 29th is an international day of giving to celebrate the importance of philanthropy. Join in by sharing your giving stories on social media using hashtag UBCGiving. Find out more at ubc.ca/GivingTuesday.
Some pigskin. This is my shimmering life prize. All I must do is create a diversion. What could distract people who love sports? Sports! 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 Sports!
Do you find sports distracting? Feel the need to chant sports for hours on end? Then come on by the CITR station at the new sub to get involved. We do play-by-play, color commentary, audio production, interviews, and so much more. Only on CITR 101.9 FM.
With us now in studio is News 101 reporter Andrew Seal, who just published an article about access to contraceptives, or lack thereof, on campus for the Thunderbird, UBC's graduate journalism publication. Andrew, let's start off with the basics. What is the iMed plan?
So basically, iMed is health insurance for international students to cover them off while they're in the three-month waiting period to get enrolled on BC's MSP plan. It's actually required for them, and it's just, it's intended to fill the gap there during that waiting time.
Okay. And can you help us understand what's happening that makes it so difficult for UBC's international student population to afford birth control?
Yeah, so basically iMed's plan doesn't include anything that they deem to be elective or like elective treatment. So, and they include contraceptives in that. And so since you need a prescription to get birth control in British Columbia, it's not available over the counter, you need to pay to see a doctor just to get the prescription, even though a lot of students who I talked to actually had birth control before and they simply just wanted to continue what they had.
You mentioned in the story that a short visit to the doctor costs $75 for a one-minute prescription writing session, and someone you spoke to told you that she uses contraceptives for other medical conditions. What does someone like her do in the circumstance where she cannot access birth control affordably on campus?
Well, unfortunately, she doesn't really have a choice since she has to keep taking her birth control. She has to pay $75 just to literally walk in the doctor's office and get him to sign a piece of paper that she can then take to the pharmacy. Other students I talked to, unfortunately, decided to stop their birth control treatment while they were waiting for MSP, even though they didn't want to, but they just... You know, they have so many costs coming here and they just didn't have a choice.
Yeah, it sounds so anxiety inducing. What was it like for you speaking to these women?
Well, it was kind of difficult to get access. It's not something that a lot of people really want to talk about. It's definitely a personal issue for a lot of people. And when I did finally get some people who would talk to me, they wouldn't even tell me their story unless I promised to grant them total anonymity and not connect them in any way with the story.
And I just want to clear one thing up. For Canadian students, is this a problem for them as well, or does iMed include these kind of prescriptions or access for them?
So basically, Canadian students generally aren't covered by iMed. Usually they're covered by MSP or another provincial healthcare plan. It could potentially affect Canadians who've been out of the country for a long time and are just coming to Vancouver to study. However, AMS, the Student Health and Dental Plan, actually does cover prescriptions, so all students get 80% of prescription costs covered. It's just students covered by IMED who need to pay to get the actual prescription in the first place.
Okay. And at the heart of it, do you think it's a matter of a clogged bureaucracy, or does UBC simply not care, medically speaking, about its international cohort? What do you, in your view, what do you think needs to change?
Well, I do think that UBC cares about its international cohort, definitely, and they want all their students to be healthy. But I think what it really comes down to is an awareness issue. Lots of people don't know about this gap in the policy. Even probably a lot of staff at UBC aren't aware of this because it affects such a small number of people, but it's a big problem for them. And otherwise, IMED is actually a good plan. It even covers up to $25,000 in maternity coverage for students who are pregnant, which kind of seems like a lot, especially when they won't cover such a small doctor's visit fee. I think what needs to change is they need to close the gap in the policy or just inform incoming international students to bring 3 months' supply of all the prescriptions they need so they don't find themselves stuck with this extra cost.
Totally agree. I'm just going to quote one of your subjects in the story. She said, "I think birth control is a human right and is very important for protecting the health and well-being of the people who use it." That kind of says it all, doesn't it?
Absolutely, Francesca. It's simply not fair for these students that during this transitional period they're stuck with these extra unexpected costs. It's a really stressful time for them, and I don't think this is how we should be welcoming new students to our university.
Thank you, Andrew, for speaking with us. You can read Andrew's entire piece and many more on www.thethunderbird.ca.
Thank you, Andrew and Francesca. Now we have Jake Clark in the studio live to discuss how to break your own media bubbles.
Howdy. Now I kind of want to ask if anyone out there is a dog person. There's a fun analogy here involving dogs. There's a good deconstruction of journalism actually involving dogs. Starting after the Second World War. 45 to 65, good 20 years mostly for our part of the world. It was the lapdog part of journalism. So if you were a journalist, generally speaking, you towed the line of your publication, you were generally reverent, and you did a fine job of basically plying your trade. It was very much a trade at the time. And then, well, let's just say the dog got a little more aggressive. You know, you got the watchdog. And that was about 15 years. Actually, probably about as long as New Hollywood lasted, because he got it from 65 to 80. And that is probably the gold standard for what I think a lot of people think about when they think about journalism, especially investigative journalism, because you have things like Watergate, you have Woodward and Bernstein, very vividly chronicled by Robert Redford, and if there's few cannier liberals than Redford, like him or not. But that didn't last, and that didn't last very long, because 1980 to present, that's the junkyard dog. Mean, hungry, and desperate. And that is where we're at with a lot of coverage coming through. You may have noticed this in the ongoing situation that you're seeing with the election in the States, yes, but also with the sort of what's been referred to on the show as creeping cretinism across the world. It's a distortion often. There's a media relation that can't be denied, and that's a little sinister. And that is because the media landscape is changing. Most people have a news feed, and I'd say, if not the majority, then close to it, get most if not all of their information from a news feed as opposed to print or television sources, which actually gives you a lot more power as a viewer because you decide what goes in your news feed. That also means you form a bubble. You probably heard that, ironically, from your news feed, because a lot of publications, especially on the left side of the spectrum, are talking about a media bubble and what that meant in this political scenario. And the danger of being in a bubble is great. It is really great. I'd say greater than a lot of people consider, because when you're in a bubble, it is very easy to view views that oppose you, views that are not affirmed very constantly by you, as being completely irrational, discounting the fact that many people believe those views as part of a worldview that is simply different from yours. Whether or not they are rational, that is different, because we, like anyone else, have a bias. We at this station have a pronounced liberal bias. I, Jake Clark, have a liberal bias speaking to you. And acknowledging that is part of maintaining that veracity. But not all media acknowledges that, because a great part of journalism, a great part of what is sold on journalism, is impartiality. And that's kind of funny, because it's a common criticism of media that they tell you what you want to hear. That's not really true anymore. They tell you what they think you want to hear right now, because you make that decision with a few clicks in a newsfeed. If you're a media site running on advertising, as many do, they need you to see the articles. And the corollary of that is that they want something that will catch your attention. And you can catch people's attention by infuriating them, but you can also catch people's attention by infuriating them in a way that is familiar, which you might have seen with the election coverage. And that's a good example. There are many other examples, but that is a good one because it's visceral. A lot of people on both sides of the spectrum hate the other candidate for many, many disparate reasons that, in all honesty, that often don't have as much bearing on their policy. And that is easy to sell. And that is how we get here. We get to a state of pathos and fury, and that's dangerous. So if you're in a bubble, and a bubble is comfortable. A bubble affirms what you think. But that's really not a way to stay well-informed. And this doesn't mean, by any means, you have to comb your news feed, throw this and that out, and replace it all with outlets that may be deemed impartial. I would say that a good way to go about this is that there is no impartial outlet. All you can do is aim for balance. There is actually a list of impartial sites that I could recommend, or less partial, I should say. ProPublica and Reuters, for example, put a high standard on that impartiality. They're also very statistics-heavy, which is something good. Reuters is actually a good business publication as a result of that. There's also independent, real news, or alternate, which are liberal-biased publications that run on an ad-free policy to prevent conflicts of interest. And PBS, BBC, or C-SPAN for video content. If you have incredibly high tolerance to tedium, I highly recommend them. C-SPAN is actually a bizarre way to see laws be put into action, which is almost terrifying at the slowness they happen. But you can also serve to balance, say, the think pieces you get every day with something across the spectrum. Now, for example, in my newsfeed, I have Salon.com and The Daily Beast, which have a lot of think pieces with a very liberal bent. If you want to balance those out, you could say, go to a place like, as much as it hurts me to say this, American Conservative, which is run by that ambulatory human excrement known as Pat Buchanan. Despite this, they've actually had some pretty good journalism in the past, and they do have a vested interest in avoiding the party line, if only because people like Pat Buchanan enjoy feeling singled out. They enjoy feeling, to an extent, unique, and that drives them to put in information that occasionally opposes their own people, as well as the people they hate. Reason is another good one, a very blatant libertarian flagship. But as with libertarians, they're basically one half liberal, and you'll probably find some things you agree on with them, even if you don't agree with the majority. Another odd recommendation is faith-based publications, because their vested interest is worn right on their sleeve. All of these things tender some explanation as to who, what, when, where, why. You got to look for that. And if you're not getting that from the media you have right now, there's a problem. In fact, this has a who, what, when, where, why to it now. Who? You. What? Media bubbles. Your media bubbles. Specifically, when? Well, that depends on when you can get the screen. Now would be nice, generally. You know, just flip through your news feed. Okay, there you go. Just add. Okay. I honestly have no idea what your guys' news feed looks like. Mine's pretty weird. And where? The news feed. And why? Well, the state of the world demands attention. How? I kind of just said. There you have it, really. Bubbles right there. Now just raise up the pin and...
Thank you, Jake. Finally, we have an arts and culture report by Anya Christina on More or Less's new album.
So I just want to quickly warn that the title has explicit content, but the album's name, today it just dropped, it's by More or Less, Toronto-based artist, and the album is Blow the Fuck Up or Stay Humble. And it is a really good 19-track album, full-length album, and it came out this morning. I would definitely recommend that you check it out. So the artist manages to fit so many bars into a beat. I mean, and it never feels like he's actually catching up with the beat. He commands the beat and just manages to fit all of his lyrics and everything he wants to say within it. If you want a dose of socially conscious rap that is tackling gender norms, teaching you how to, you know, really prioritize a financially stable life and even get a little bit mad at the current state of gun laws in North America, he's definitely the guy to listen to because he argues against it all and he's just doing the Canadian thing, which is to be super liberal and preach the right things, in my opinion, back to the media bubbles thing, because I too have a liberal bias that I would like to acknowledge. So definitely check it out. It's on Spotify, it's on iTunes, it's pretty much everywhere with free streaming, and support a fellow Canadian.
Thank you, Anya. That's our program for November 25th. Today's newscast was brought to you by talented volunteer efforts. If you would like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news/101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud and MixCloud pages. For more independent news, join us next.